Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, and you join us on a day in which Tom and I have had some very good news, so we're both feeling absolutely splendid. And Tom, you're feeling particularly chipper, aren't you? Because this famous book, I mean, you're the first person, I think, in recorded history to write a book.
Yes.
Judging by the number of times we hear about it. But this famous book is, if not completed, it is extraordinarily close to completion, isn't it?
Well, the main body is finished.
Yeah.
It's got such a good last line. Shall I tell you what it is?
Yeah, go on.
The Romans always win.
That is a good line.
Yeah, it's an excellent. It's a piece of graffiti that was found in the Jordanian desert. So I'm very pleased with that.
Oh, it's not your own line.
No, it's
what a great bit of graffiti. It's
authentic
that is.
Piece of graffiti.
They always win, of course, until they don't.
Well, quite.
That's the story of Roman history.
But the period that I'm covering, they always win. So I'm now into the preface. So I've begun it with Hadrian visiting the banks of the Tyne. So Dan Jackson will be very happy with that. In fact, the Tyne is mentioned in the very first sentence. And then look at the way that Hadrian's Wall has been interpreted. Got in a little bit of Game of Thrones. Just got to Gibbon.
Sounds good.
So, very happy. So I'm taking a break from doing that to do this. But then the moment that's over, I'm straight back in.
Have the publishers designed the cover yet?
No, not yet. But they're busy looking at Trajan's Column, which, are they? You know, that's an illustrator's dream, isn't
it? Have you chosen the pictures?
I haven't done that yet. I mean, that's always the most fun bit. Choosing the pictures, working out the maps.
I always choose the pictures while I'm writing.
Yeah, of course. I've compiled them. Well, it's a bit like when we do the pictures for our tweets that we put out. It's always my favourite bit.
Yeah, the pictures are great. I had a massive sort of library, about 500 or 600 Getty images, pictures for... Because, of course, there's such a wealth of images for the kind of early 1980s. And whittling them down was enormously... kind of working out what would go where.
The Roman ones are obviously, you have to, harder to kind of track down.
Yeah.
So when you see them, you have to grab them.
Yeah, of course. Do you take some yourself?
Yeah, some. But I'm also very, very lucky that Sophie Hay, who came on to talk about Pompeii, and she's been out in Pompeii quite a lot, and she's been taking me some wonderful shots. She's a very, very good photographer. So,
well, that's nice.
Bless her.
Very good.
Yeah, so it's all go. And then of course, I've got the maps, which I love a map.
Yeah. Do you do the maps yourself?
I kind of draw them and then I send them off to the official cartographer, the map maker. Yeah. So the best bit is yet to come.
But the thing about doing books, isn't it, is it's never, ever finished. So you think you're finished and then they come back with some small changes and then you've got your copy editor and then you've got the proofs. And so you're never quite done with it, are you? I mean, there is that feeling of satisfaction when you finish the first draft, but there's never a sort of moment where you can put it out of your mind.
Well, you think there is when it comes out in English, don't you?
Yeah, I suppose.
And you think, oh, thank God, that's out. But when Dominion came out in German...
Did you read it in German? No.
No, but I had a professor of church history. He read it for the publisher and came back with kinds of queries about the...
A German professor of church history? That sounds absolutely terrible.
I have failed to find the supplement you mentioned to the codicil of... And it was under lockdown, and there were all kinds of questions about, references to various obscure church documents that I simply couldn't get. And I just wrote back to him and said, I can't get to them. So that was.
What did he say?
He was very understanding. He was charming. He was lovely.
Oh, that's good.
He was very sympathetic.
I mean, it's good that we're not. So I don't know whether we have members who are academics. We probably do have one or two. I think there's nothing worse than that thing that sort of full-time academics have to do, where they write a journal article and they send it into the publisher. The journal then sends it to three other academics who moan and groan and send in reader's reports.
Peer review.
And then that's sort of, they've all got vested interests. They're all just stabbing each other in the back the whole time. It's just a ghastly kind of, and I just think, I want to say what I want to say.
But it can be very useful. I mean, if you've missed out something or if they've got perspective or...
You see, I have no interest in anybody else's view of my work because I'm just too arrogant. So I'm not interested in readers' reports.
I suppose that is the difference between us, that you are just compulsively arrogant, whereas I have natural humility.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that people do associate with you on this podcast, Tom, actually, is natural humility. So when can we expect publication of the book?
It's next September.
So September, and it will be called PAX.
Be called PAX, yeah.
Very exciting.
And, who knows, perhaps just conceivably, we might do an episode or two.
We might. Of course, by then, Tom, we'll have done episodes about Fury of the Vikings, which is coming out before Christmas, and on The Quest for El Dorado, which will be coming out sometime next
year. Is that what it's called, The Quest for El Dorado?
Yeah, we've been back and forth on the... So this is an interesting... I'd be interested to hear your view, actually. So originally, it was going to be called The Conquest of the Americas. This is a kid's book about the conquistadors, the Aztecs and the Incas. And there was a little bit of disquiet at Penguin because they said, oh, it makes it sound very old-fashioned, like conquest and, you know, the Spanish, the protagonists. And what about how are we going to work in the Aztecs and the Incas and their lovely traditions of, you know, basket weaving and stuff.
And sacrifice.
And I said, well, you could just call it the Aztecs and the Incas, but that just sounds like you're lumping in two different things. So we went back and forth. And eventually it was actually Arthur who said, you should call it something like The Quest for El Dorado because everybody likes a quest. And even if they don't know what El Dorado is, it sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's very Tintin.
Yeah, exactly. It's very Tintin. And that was, he suggested it clearly with Tintin in mind.
It's a brilliant title. Are you going to mention, though, as a kind of postscript, Colonel Percy Fawcett?
Oh, no. But I should. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, you should. Great story. What happened to him? He vanished, didn't he?
He did vanish.
Looking for it in, what, the 20s, I think?
I think it is something like the 20s.
Because we mentioned him. He was a friend of Ian Fleming.
And his brother, Peter Fleming. Peter Fleming had gone to try and find him or something, hadn't he? Is that right?
Yeah.
The lost city of Zed. That's it. Yeah. In the jungles of Brazil.
Yeah.
He went missing in 1925. I'm doing live research. That is a great, great epilogue. Tom, I'll have to thank you in the...
You can give me a credit.
Yeah, I will give you a credit. So, now talking of books... books and authors have obviously been in the news in the last few days for quite grim reasons. Because on Friday, so actually just before we get onto this, on Friday I went for lunch with a couple of friends of mine. And as we were leaving, we bumped into one of our members. So Lewis, I think it was Lewis Clark, I think it is, who works at Fisher's in London. So Lewis, it was lovely to meet you and hello. But as I was leaving that restaurant, I heard the news about Salman Rushdie. Who was stabbed multiple times in New York State before giving a lecture about freedom of speech. And Tom, this is a really, not just for any writer, but for, you know, anybody who loves literature or indeed freedom of speech. It's a ghastly story, isn't it?
Yeah, although he seems to be pulling out now, doesn't he? He's speaking, I think. I mean, he's got life-changing injuries and...
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, terrible. Absolutely terrible. And... I think the thing that is impressive about Rushdie is that he is as clearly as brave a man as he is great a novelist. And that is not always a combination that goes together. No. And it's really noticeable in the, you know, a lot of journalists who've interviewed him have been talking about it and the way that they've said that he just didn't want to be defined by it. You know, he would be resentful of having to talk about it. Because aside from anything else, he's far, far too great a writer to be defined by it. I mean, he always will be. It'll always be a part of how he's seen and understood. But I mean, he really is, I think, I mean, certainly the greatest living British novelist, I think.
That's a big claim because there are, I mean, Kazuo Ishiguro is got to be a contender. But Tom, if you're right in the sense that when people do these Booker of Booker, sort of competitions. In fact, they did do a Booker of Booker, I think to mark its 30th anniversary or 40th anniversary or something, which was the very best Booker Prize winner, and Midnight's Children, which was the book that really made his name, a kind of classic of post-colonial literature, a book sort of all about the legacy of empire and what it was to be both Indian and British and all that sort of thing. That's his defining, that's a defining book of our times, isn't it?
I mean, that's why I would rate it, you know, it's a kind of invidious thing to rate novelists, but I think that he understood much more clearly than most other British novelists of his generation, for obvious reasons, that Britain's relationship with its imperial past, that the multiculturalism of Britain, that all of these issues were going to be the great themes. And he was on top of them way before lots of others. And the richness and the sophistication and the cleverness and the humour and the complexity of the way in which he has always handled these themes, I think, makes his corpus of fiction unrivaled. And I would say that people say The Satanic Verses isn't a good novel. I think it's a brilliant novel. And I think that one of the measures of how brilliant a novel it is that it has put its finger on so many issues and tensions within contemporary Western society. And that's why you know, it's had the reaction it is. It takes a great novel to have that effect.
So it's published in 1988 and the fatwa was declared in 1989. And I think we both remember, many of our British listeners will remember, the book being burned in Bradford, in the north of England, a city that had seen enormous immigration and a big Muslim population. And I think that was the first moment, wasn't it, where multiculturalism and the sort of complexities of multiculturalism became a subject of really sort of heated political debate in Britain. Because before then, people had been actually kind of oblivious almost to the fact that Britain had become a multicultural society. And it was Rushdie's book and the reaction to it that kind of awakened that debate.
I think also there was an obliviousness as to the way that Islam was a very distinct, complex, rich, sophisticated civilization that couldn't simply be bundled into the kind of the overall overarching fabric of, say, a British multicultural state without incredible tensions. And everything that's happened since, I think, demonstrates that. But it's worth remembering that Rushdie himself is a Muslim. And he is as much a representative of that Islamic civilization as the Ayatollah was.
Yeah, and he's not the only Muslim novelist to have had this treatment, of course, because you think of Naguib Mahfouz, the great Nobel Prize-winning Egyptian writer. He was attacked. I can't remember when that was. I think that was possibly in the 1990s. Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish novelist, has had death threats, so on. So, I mean, Rushdie's not, he's not alone, but he's the most famous, the most celebrated. I mean, of course, he has this bounty on his head from the Iranian government that has never been lifted. And to live with that and to continue writing and to continue coming out in public and giving lectures and things, I mean, it does take incredible. I can't imagine the courage. But Tom, actually, you can. Because as our producers point out in the notes for this episode, you in your own way have had this sort of experience, haven't you? So tell the listeners.
Nothing comparable.
So you wrote your book, it was The Shadow of the Sword, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In which you talk. It's partly about the age of Justinian and so on, but it's also about the emergence of Islam. And you did a two-part, I think, documentary?
No, it's a one-part. On that, it was a little bit like kind of sinking into sinking sands or, you know, a treacherous bog or something. Because my aim in writing The Shadow of the Sword was that I'd looked at the Roman architecture in Constantinople and Ravenna, and then at the Dome of the Rock. And it's so clear when you put it in that context that the Dome of the Rock is basically a Roman building, you know, dome, the mosaics, everything. And so I wanted to look at and ask, well, were the Arabs relative to the Romans what the Ostrogoths were, you know, to that extent, were the Arabs a kind of late antique kingdom, which I knew was a kind of very, very much kind of current thinking. And so that was the book I wanted to write. But the problem was that to do that, ultimately, the only way to look at that was to jettison the traditional Islamic accounts, which were much later. And that was like kind of tugging on the thread of a rug. So it ended up with me having to question much about what Muslim tradition says about the life of Muhammad, about the origins of the Quran, all kinds of stuff. And if you're interested in hearing a podcast about that and you haven't listened to the episode on Muhammad, we talk about it in that episode.
Yeah.
But the book itself, although it did generate some very intemperate responses, didn't create any real, it wasn't the real flashpoint. We also made a film about it for Channel 4, which came out actually 10 years ago this month. And Channel 4, I thought, were, you know, hats off to them for commissioning it. And they screened it and everything. But there was an incredible nervousness around it because I was kind of popping up and saying, I didn't think Muhammad came from Mecca and all this kind of stuff, and that it was the Arab Empire that made Islam rather than the other way around and all kinds of stuff like that. So they were a bit nervous about it. And so when the film went out, the briefing notes that they sent out to the press didn't mention anything about it being controversial. It just said that, you know, Tom Holland goes in search of the beginnings of Islam, and they left it at that. And so I think that Muslims who in Britain who are often starved of Islamically themed material on TV, certainly terrestrial TV, all thought, brilliant, you know, a film about the Prophet, wonderful, let's all sit down and watch it. And were absolutely appalled, lots of them, by what they saw.
Yeah.
And I remember getting a phone call from from the police even before the film had ended, saying, "We really must come around and check your windows." So it was horrible. It was kind of horrible for weeks and weeks and weeks. There were kind of endless threats. And I remember one particularly alarming moment where Press TV, which is the the television channel of the Iranian Republic.
Iranian. Didn't Jeremy Corbyn used to be a pundit on Press TV? Or?
Yes, he did. Yeah. He did. And it was at the same time as, you may remember, the American ambassador, was it in Libya? Or was it, I think it was in Libya, got murdered.
Yeah.
And
because
there had been a Coptic, so an Egyptian Christian in California, had made a very, very overtly abusive and blasphemous film about Muhammad that had gone out. And so there was a kind of mob lynched the American ambassador by way of comeback. And Press TV put a film out equating my film, in which I'm almost painfully nervous about saying anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I do say things that obviously a believing Muslim would disagree with, but in a tone of impeccable respect, nervous respect, and this openly abusive film. And that day, there was a lot of nervousness because I guess, you know, had a butterfly flapped its wings in a different way in Chile, we could all have been I know, burnt in effigy and going into police hiding and all that kind of stuff. But that, nothing happened and it passed and then it's all faded and I don't have any trouble with it at all now. So
you have no grounds for, for defensiveness, because the argument that you put forward is one that there's a respectable, very, you know, respectable academic argument, isn't there? That what we think of as Islam kind of was partly... it's clearly a response to things that are going on in the Eastern fringe of the Roman Empire and the kind of swirl of Jewish and Christian ideas. And then that when they get the Arabs do their conquests and they get to the Levant and Jerusalem and Syria and so on, that then that starts to become codified as a separate religion, I guess.
I think... Rushdie's courage in writing and publishing the Stanic Verses was of a wholly different order. Firstly, because he was a Muslim, he was a Muslim. I mean, he no longer believing Muslim. So therefore, by the standards of traditional Islam, he would rank as an apostate, and apostasy is condemned, you know, is something to be punished by death according to traditional standards. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that writing a novel, of course, you have vastly more agency than if you're writing history. And it's entirely, you know, obviously I'm not a Muslim, so therefore I don't think that the Quran came from God. And so therefore I have to discover some alternative explanation for it. And I think that, you know, that's why the book never generated death threats, because Muslims could entirely accept that.
Yeah, but don't do yourself down, Tom. I mean, I know we talk all the time about your intense humility on this podcast.
Yes.
Don't do yourself down too much, because it does take courage to write about a subject that you think could conceivably result in you getting death threats. I mean, that takes tremendous courage.
I remember because it gradually dawned on me, because I hadn't fully thought through the implications of what it was that I was trying to do. I write a narrative history of the emergence of Islam that doesn't say, well, he got it from an angel, because essentially, if you look at a lot of even academic works, say works by academics, they will still say this. They will still say, you know, they'll rehash the traditional Muslim account about Jibreel, Gabriel coming, all that kind of stuff. I mean, but if you're not doing that, then you have no option but to start sinking into some quite alarming sands. And I do remember, it's kind of process of months of feeling more and more nervous about it as I was writing it. Anyway, but it was all fine. So,
okay. Well, let's move on to more amusing matters. The career of the former US President Donald Trump. Tom, we have been invited to consider the...
You have, because I know nothing about this. This is the raid on Trump's Mar-a-Lago kind of resort in Florida. And they forced a safe, and they found a number of top secret files.
Top secret files.
Relating to Macron and to...
What's he got on Macron? That's what I want to know. I really want to read that file.
Because there's all this kind of nuclear stuff, but What's he got on Macron? That's what I want to know.
Well, he and Macron had this history, didn't they? Because they did this very, very long handshake.
Yes.
Remember? And neither of them would let go. And I wonder whether it's Trump maybe is a bit bitter about Macron with his handshake or something. Who knows?
But anyway, but Dominic, the reason that this has been mentioned isn't just because it's inherently interesting, but also because it's a week since Nixon gave his resignation speech, 8th of August, 1974.
It's a week since the anniversary, yeah. Yeah.
Could a link be made between Nixon's tapes and Trump's files, do you think?
Well, a few people have asked that, actually, I think, and talked about it on the Discord. I think it's slightly different. I mean, Nixon's tapes, they're a very unusual historical source, which Nixon, for very understandable reasons, we talked about this in the Watergate episode, didn't want to release because it would embarrass him and it would incriminate him in the Washington inquiry. But Nixon, of course, was a sitting president at that point. Trump is obviously not a sitting president and appears to have left office with a load of stuff and have sort of hidden a load of stuff.
So why do you think he's done that? I mean, seriously, what?
God, I mean, I don't pretend. I'm not a kind of clinical psychiatrist. God knows what goes on. And I mean, does he have files that, I mean.
Is it a kind of souvenir or?
We don't know because we don't know what's in them.
No.
There's some claims, some journalists have said he's been flushing file, ripping them up.
Down the toilet.
Putting them down the toilet. I mean, who knows? Who knows, Tom? I think the interesting thing about it, though, is that I wrote an article for Unheard about this, that actually, to me, I don't really care about Donald Trump's paperwork one way or the other, but is how the reaction to it has just, as always, has divided totally on party lines. So almost all the Republicans say this is an absolutely disgraceful abuse of state power.
That kind of is different from 1974.
Now, that is the difference with the Nixon thing. So the really interesting thing is the difference in the political culture. And I think this tells whether you are a Republican or a Democrat, or you have no dog in the fight, I think it tells quite a depressing story about the deterioration of the health of the American political culture. And indeed, I mean, that's not completely without parallels in Europe, by the way, or in Britain. The way in which a sort of sense of bipartisanship or objectivity, that the idea that there could be a neutral position, has evaporated. So obviously when Nixon left, it was partly because he'd completely lost the support of the Republican congressional leadership, who just thought Nixon's beyond the pale, he's crossed a line, he's behaved very poorly. You know, it's embarrassing for our party, but he has to go. And people don't think like that. Or at least I suspect some people do think like that in the Republican Party, but they just think, I'll be torpedoing my own career if I say so. So I have to fall into line behind our former president. And I just think that when you're in that position, that kind of ultra tribalism, I think that bodes very ill for the health of your democracy. And by the way, I don't think it's just confined to Republicans. I think it's possibly worse on the Republican side of the ledger. Some of our listeners may say this is metropolitan snowflakery on my part. I mean, the Democrats are often equally partisan. I just think once you get into that spiral as a political culture, it's actually really hard to get out of it because there's no reward for being the centrist voice of reason.
If only they were still making the X-Files, it would be so obvious what those files were.
UFOs, aliens.
All that kind of thing. It'd be much more exciting than stuff about Macron's handshake.
Are you an admirer of Stranger Things, Tom?
I've seen the first two series, but I need to... Dominic, I don't have time to watch.
You do have time. That is it's one of the very striking things about you is you will send me a WhatsApp message at 3 p.m. telling me how incredibly busy you are and hardworking and beleaguered.
It's
and
true.
And then at 6:30, I will see a tweet from you that says... Off to the cinema, off to the Oval.
Well, I've got a chap has to.
And I think here is a man time. Who does not know how to knuckle down.
Well, talking of the Oval.
Yeah. Yes, this was my link for you.
Famous cricket ground. Very, very exciting that Carlos Brathwaite.
Who is this person?
Barbadian cricketer. Well, he's principally, he plays in the shorter form of the game, which involves hitting the ball very, very miles and miles and miles over the boundary. So he's a lovely man, excellent commentator. He went to school with Rihanna, friends with Rihanna.
Yeah.
But his greatest feat was that in the T20, so that's 20 overs each, final in, I think, 2016, he hit four sixes in a row off Ben Stokes in the final over to win the match. So
three more sixes than you hit off that child, Tom.
That's the measure of his achievement. Anyway, so he's a fabulous commentator, and apparently he was commentating on a match, and they started talking about pigeons, which is what they often do in cricket commentary. And people mentioned you should listen to our very exciting podcast on pigeons. And so he said he would. And I piled in and said, yeah, please do. Big fan. And he listened to it. And so this is from Came18, and he's given a report. Listening to the cricket just now, I heard the fabulous Barbadian cricketer Carlos Brathwaite discussing the recent Rest Is History episode about pigeons. So surprised I had to play it back just to make sure that I hadn't hallucinated. It was a long chat about 20 minutes into the Welsh Fire inning, so that's a 100 match. Carlos admitted that he'd taken notes and repeated many top anecdotes from the podcast.
Taken notes.
That's the kind of commitment we like, isn't it?
It is. I think we should try to, but I'm disappointed that it's cricket that has picked this up and not football.
Well, you don't have time to talk about pigeons, do you, in a football match?
No, but when like Cristiano Ronaldo or somebody is tweeting that he's been listening to The Rest Is History about Justine and Theodora.
But Dominic, we're about to do episodes on Portugal, aren't we? So
he'll have no excuse, and they will be very popular episodes in the streets of Wolverhampton with all the Portuguese players. Their finest Portuguese players ply their trade, Tom.
And indeed Stockwell, where all the fans live, Portuguese fans.
Yeah, there is a sort of little Portugal.
Yeah, little Lisbon, yeah.
Very nice. All right, talking of Justine and Theodora, we've had a couple of comments. So this is from David Top Reverend Nicholson. Tim Vasby Burney, there is a claimant to your crown.
Oh, this is like the Great Schism.
It is. He says, did anyone else make the mistake of starting episode one of Justine and Theodora with an 8-year-old in the car? I had to endure a lecture about how this history is inappropriate for kids and very cringe. So, Tom, you were the person who gave that introduction. How do you plead?
Yes, I was. I plead entirely guilty, and perhaps we should have put out a trigger warning, although you got very cross about that, didn't you? You felt that was an infringement of our free speech, the right to put out filth and porn.
Absolutely shameful moment when Dom, our producer, is pointing out that the episode was marked with an E for explicit. So this is
that's what E means.
So this is Theodora's interactions with the geese, but also her peculiar brand of gymnastics, where she would arch her back and all that stuff on stage, according to Procopius. Almost, I would say, quite possibly not true, but you take a perhaps more jaundiced view, Tom. But you put up a absolutely weaselly tweet saying...
It wasn't weaselly. I was apologising.
I'm so sorry. We should have issued a trigger warning. This is terrible. We've caused great harm and mental health problems to the people.
Dominic, I think you are exaggerating there. I don't believe...
Anyway, I gave you the ticking off. I gave you the... were we in the business of providing trigger warnings, Tom?
Well, Dominic, can I redeem myself by talking about sex dolls?
Dogs or dolls?
Dolls.
Dolls. Sex dogs. I thought that was Procopius again.
No, sex dolls. So yeah, we talked earlier about the illustrations that we put up.
We did.
When we advertise our episodes. And for the final episode on Justine and Theodora was on the secret history. So I thought it would be amusing and apposite to pair the famous mosaics of Justine and Theodora with images of how Procopius cast them. So I found with some effort a picture of a man with no features corresponding to
your Google search history must be well worth reading.
and so then I started looking for a portrayal of Theodora as somebody who would arch her back and do all the kind of stuff that was very cringe, and it led me to the extraordinary discovery that there is a Theodora sex doll. And it's made, well, I won't go into the details, but she has pure skin, an hourglass figure, comes to you today with beautiful, boasting 11 eye colours, 10 makeup options, 10 lip colours, and 10 nail and toenail options.
Toenail options.
So this is on the ad, this is on the webpage, but it then goes on, Theodora was of humble birth, born in the year 500 AD. Her father was a bear trainer in the Byzantine capital, Constantinople.
This is where you did your research.
Theodora rebuilt and reformed Constantinople and made it the most beautiful city the world had seen since Rome. The greatest achievement of her reign is the Hagia Sophia, considered the epitome of Byzantine architecture and one of the architectural wonders of the Christian world. So I had no idea that sex doll manufacturers were giving a feminist spin on Byzantine history. which I think is rather wonderful in a way.
We should definitely look into some sort of link up with them, shouldn't we, Tom?
Maybe they could sponsor us.
Yeah. I mean, you made such a hullabaloo when we started this podcast about how you wanted a local mead company to sponsor us.
Well, there's, yeah.
And those days are now past. But why don't you get in touch with the manufacturers and say, we will do ads. We can do them very amusing themed ads around their particular individual products.
I mean, we would have to carry trigger warnings on the historical inaccuracies.
I'm not into the trigger warnings, Tom. I'll tell you that.
No,
now.
We can't. We cannot have them saying that Theodora built Hagia Sophia.
What, you want a trigger warning for historical inaccuracy?
Yes, I think we'd have to agree to that.
I mean, if that's the case, we'd be running trigger warnings all the time.
No, but that's a very basic one. That's a very basic one. Anyway, enough of this, enough of this. Stephen Clark, hearty perennial friend of the show.
Yeah, very much.
So he is, this is the discussion about education. He says it's a myth that the only history British secondary school children learn about is 1066, Henry VIII and the Nazis. The history teachers I know look at a much broader range of topics than that. However, I doubt many UK schools do any or a significant amount of Byzantine history. So hopefully these episodes will spark a reassessment of that. Well, it'd be wonderful to think that. I mean, it is such a fascinating theme.
It is.
But it's complicated, isn't it?
No school's ever going to do Byzantine history. I mean, why would they in Britain? It would be a mad choice. I mean, I think Byzantine history is unbelievably fascinating. But if you were listing the 20 things that a British 16-year-old should know about.
The premiership of Callaghan, early years of the Thatcher government. Yeah.
Exactly.
Heath
exactly.
government. Yeah. And they're piling up, aren't they?
Wilson 1, Wilson 2.
Not much room for Justinian there.
Not much room. No, I think Stephen is right. I think that it's a myth, but I think it's also true that, I mean, this is a whole subject in and of itself, the teaching of history in schools, and we've sometimes touched on this. I think the single biggest problem they have is such limited time.
Yeah.
So some schools, they're only doing 40 minutes a week. I mean, what the hell can you do in 40 minutes? But also, for understandable reasons, teachers want to do the subjects that will attract, you know, lots of kids to do them because they're accessible, that there are lots of resources for them, that it's kind of easy and straightforward to do, that the teacher knows. I mean, there's lots of kind of institutional, almost kind of infrastructural reasons.
I mean, 1066, Henry VIII and the Nazis are important to know about. So
they are important. It's a slightly boring cliche, isn't it? Oh, all you know about is Henry VIII and the Nazis. I mean, they're two pretty, the Reformation and the Third Reich are two pretty big historical topics, and not to know about them would be a bit odd. So Tom, I think we've pretty much run out of, have we run out of things to say? If you run out of things to say, you know.
Well, I've got one last stat.
Yeah.
Which is that the Rest is History Club, we are currently 2,999 members.
So that's on the Discord. We actually have more members than that. 2,999 of them have signed up to the Discord. So there are other members who refuse to go onto the Discord.
Which I respect.
Yeah, I respect it too. But I wonder who the 3,000th member will be. It's very exciting.
Very exciting. Maybe by the time you listen to this, because we're recording this on Monday, this will be going out on Wednesday, maybe we will be over the, we'll have breasted the 3,000 mark.
We will indeed. So what we've got coming up, you have the two first holiday episodes. So that's the Grand Tour, and then it's Victorian holidays, really. Then we have one on 20th century holidays. So that's called Sun, Sea, and Sex, coming next week. And then Tom gives an absolute, as Tom himself would call it, a tour de force on Roman holidays. Next week, and we're going to be recording our next big recording moments are going to be two episodes on the history of Portugal, and I imagine it'll be two episodes, won't it, Tom, on the life and times and works of J.R.R. Tolkien, perfectly timed for the new Amazon TV series. So lots of excitement.
Yeah. And we're speaking to Neil Price, who wrote
one of
the most intriguing books that I've read over the past decade. We're going to be talking about the theme of that book, which is basically Viking sorcery. So
yeah,
we'll be unmissable.
Very exciting.
So I hope you enjoy all those when they come out. And have a lovely summer. Enjoy your holidays and see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.